fairly obvious to me that there is not a lot of social life at Charlottesville on Friday afternoon.
Well, we think it's obvious that all of you have very good judgment.
You'll see in a minute whether that's right or not.
Jefferson spoke about the aristocracy of talent and the requirements of office. Jackson said the tasks of government ought to be so simple that any citizen could assume them. For 31 years in the Department of State and Foreign Service, Larry Eagleburger has accumulated an experience and a knowledge of foreign policy that is almost unparalleled in recent history. We feel very privileged, therefore, that he is in residence part-time at the center, and that groups such as ours tonight have an opportunity to visit with him, to hear him, and exchange ideas. The subject this evening is foreign policy in the 1996 election and any extrapolation that the Secretary chooses to make on that topic.
First of all, I want to introduce my wife, who is sitting behind me. I need to explain this. She doesn't like it when I tell this story, but every once in a while I bring her along sort of to critique me afterward. And I used to do that when I'd come off television. I'd come home and I'd say, well, how did I do? And she'd say, well, you pulled your ear too much or you snuffled or whatever. I came home one night and I said, how did I do? And she said, if you don't stop eating, I'm going to sew your damn mouth shut. It may be fairly obvious to you that that is advice I have not yet taken. But I also was glad that Ken mentioned Thomas Jefferson, because as a newcomer to Virginia, or to this part of Virginia, having spent 5 years or so here now, it's always important to hear him mentioned, because as I have gone around Charlottesville, I have discovered that almost all of you are in some way or another related to him. At least claim relationships. I will talk about the 1996 election and foreign policy to the degree I can. I hope you all understand that, well, I'm the one who volunteered the subject. The more I've thought about it, the more I'm not sure what we should talk about, because it's still 2 years away. And so a lot of this is guesswork. And to some degree, I'll put my own prejudices into things. I'll try to identify them when I do. But to some degree, it's, I think, just a question of trying to analyze and guess what the subjects will be and where people will be on it. And I need to start by saying it's fairly obvious, it is reasonably obvious, that Mr. Clinton will be the Democratic nominee next time. Although there is, I suppose, some question about that, at least in Mr. Gebhardt's mind. What is not at all clear is who the Republican candidate is going to be. And I think just to make a point here, which is not related to foreign policy, but is to the process of the nomination. This year and this time, in terms of the Republican nomination, is going to be quite different than almost any other time we've seen, for reasons that are now becoming increasingly obvious. Most important of all is the fact that something like two-thirds of the delegates to the Republican convention will be chosen by, I think it is, the end of April. And having moved the California primary up, for example, there is little chance for the candidates who are trying to get the nomination to, if they do well in New Hampshire and Iowa, it used to be they could use that as a bounce to try to raise money for the rest of the primary, the nominating process, including primaries. That isn't going to work this time, because they aren't going to have time to raise that money. So what we're all seeing and beginning to hear is that those people who are going to run for the nomination this year, this time, are going to have to get their money this year. And frankly, that is, I think, more than any other single reason why Cheney, Kemp, and now Quayle have withdrawn. The estimate is, and I think a fair estimate, is that you need at least $20 million this year in order to run an adequate campaign for the nomination. So we are now down at the moment at least to Dole, Lamar Alexander, and Senator Graham. We may see Pete Wilson from California in the race. He can probably still raise the money. But the longer this goes on, the tougher that's going to be. There is another reason why Wilson may not even decide to run, because I know the Republicans are putting tremendous pressure on him, because the lieutenant governor in California is a Democrat, and they are worried that if he were in fact to get the nomination, the state would then have a Democratic governor, and it's too big a state to easily do that. It is also, I think, true that they are worried that simply being out of the state campaigning will in fact, because the lieutenant governor under California law becomes the governor anytime the governor is out of the state, so that's another pressure point. I think Mr. Dole has a problem in trying to be majority leader and run for the nomination at the same time. As some of you know, I'm associated with Howard Baker and his law firm in Washington, and Howard, in fact, tried precisely that in 1980 to run for the presidency, and also he was majority leader in the Senate, and he has told me that he learned very quickly that you can't do both. And if you want to be majority leader, you better give up any idea of trying to run for the nomination. Now, Dole may be in a different position, but I don't think so. So, I'm not trying to push any particular Republican candidate. All I'm saying is it is somewhat difficult to predict, or it's quite difficult to predict who the Republican candidate will be. It is not difficult to predict that it will be, I think, probably decided well before the Republican convention, probably by the end of the first quarter, or certainly the first third of 1996. And we'll have a much better picture then of where the party will be going. I think it is going to make a difference who the candidate is, in the sense of the degree to which the Republican Party is more or less internationally intended. And I think there will be, and I think there is now, and I think there will be for some time, a struggle within the Republican Party, given all of the new faces there, as to the degree to which the Republicans will continue the kind of Bush involvement in foreign policy, or move back toward a less intense involvement. In fact, I should say to you, I think I travel around the country a good bit, and I should say to you that I think unless there is a cataclysm of some sort internationally within the next year, and foreign policy, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because I think it's terribly important we focus and think about the subject, but I think unfortunately it is not going to be a particularly vital concern throughout most of the campaign. We saw in the last election, and I'm not trying to defend Bush, but simply to say that the Republican candidate who was clearly more than above average on foreign policy, although you may argue was not on domestic policy, that the foreign policy side of things, even in the aftermath of the Kuwait War, really didn't carry much weight. I now spent some time talking to some 70 new Republicans in the House, and I find virtually no interest in foreign affairs, except as it relates to budget, how do we cut the budget, with the exception of the military, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But there is no overwhelming enthusiasm for foreign affairs on the Republican side in the House this year. In fact, they had to work very hard there and in the Senate to persuade some of these new people to go on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which is now given another name, which I can't remember, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They had, in the past, particularly the Senate Foreign Relations Committee used to be a plum assignment. Most of these new senators didn't want on it. And they had to really, in at least two cases I know of, they had to promise them a second major committee in order to persuade them to go on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So you are, I think, I'm trying to give you some sense that I think on the Republican side, and as you all know, I am one, but nevertheless, I must tell you, I think there really is a substantial diminution within the Republican Party in interest in foreign affairs. Now, I should also say to you that that also depends to some degree on whether you have a president who is interested in foreign affairs. And when Bush was president, he sort of dragged a lot of fairly reluctant Republicans along simply because he was of their party and was interested in foreign affairs. But for the next 2 years, without that Republican authority in the White House, I think you can expect that the Congress, both Senate and House, is going to be less than interested in foreign affairs. And that way may well carry over. In fact, I think almost inevitably will carry over into the election itself, unless there is some international disaster in the meantime that forces our attention there. As I said earlier, I think that's tragic because, as some of you heard me here before, I think we in the United States face, put it differently, as I've said before, I think we are in a post-revolutionary period that's as critical historically as the post-French Revolution, the post-Russian Revolution. And what we do in the next few years in a period of semi-chaos, or certainly great instability, to begin to think through what it is we want to see happen in the 21st century, and what our role ought to be, and what the democracy's role ought to be. What do we do about the UN? What do we do about a whole host of institutions? I think now is more than time to be seriously thinking about that. And again, trying not to be partisan, but let me simply say, I don't think this administration has thought about it for 2.5 minutes. I don't think that the new Republican Congress is going to be thinking about it for 2.5 minutes either. I will only say to you that it is evident from too much history that Congress never thinks far ahead anyway. But if we go into this next election with the sort of inattention to foreign affairs, that in fact sort of antagonism toward it, that I think is possible from both parties. I should have said earlier, I don't see any evidence on the Democratic side either of any great enthusiasm for involvement in foreign affairs. And therefore, I think it's going to be a period, this 2 years and the presidential election, I fear, is going to be a period of fairly sterile debate, if any debate at all, about foreign policy. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that I think will develop in the next 2 years, or certainly will be a focus, and I think a negative focus, in the next presidential election. And the first one, I predict to you now that aid as we have known it for the last 50 years is a thing of the past. I frankly believe that there will be no AID by the time of the next presidential election. I think there is clearly a major intention on the part of the Republicans in the House and in the Senate to either thoroughly revamp the agency or simply get rid of it and put its functions, whatever peripheral functions may be left, probably into the State Department. Now let me just say to you, I don't think that's bad, and I understand I will not be popular with at least a good bit of the more liberal faculty in this university. But the fact of the matter is, at least as I see it, that the institution is one of the most bedraggled, bureaucracy-ridden, unimaginative, wasteful dens of iniquity now extant in Washington. And I will tell you that if George Bush had won the last election, I think you would have seen his administration substantially are aiming at either a substantial revamping of AID with a real downsizing and with a substantial reduction in the appropriations for overseas, for assistance overseas, or in fact the destruction of the agency and putting it somewhere else. What's going on, and this may happen, by the way, before the election, if the Republicans can manage the process through a Senate where there will certainly be efforts to filibuster against it. And also after some very serious committee considerations. But there is at least a strong chance that AID and the whole concept of foreign aid will have been substantially revamped by this Republican Congress before there's even a presidential election. If it hasn't succeeded, I will bet you $10 to a hole in a donut that it will be to the degree foreign affairs will be an issue in the next presidential election. This will be an issue that the Republicans will be pushing hard. I must say to you, I don't think the Democrats will fight it very hard. So what I guess I am really saying to you is, either in the next 2 years or certainly in the next four, I think we're going to see the United States in a substantially different position with regard to overseas assistance, economic assistance, than we have been used to for the last 40 years, 40 or 50 years. What's going on in the debate right now in Washington within the Republican, amongst the Republicans who are thinking about this subject, and the senator from Kentucky, whose name I... McConnell is working on a bill now that would... Thank you. Are you from Kentucky or just smart? Anyway, he's working on a bill now that would, in fact, probably do away with the agency. I think where they're aiming now is a substantially reduced, well, destroy AID or eliminate AID, what is left of it moved into the State Department under the charge of a special Undersecretary of State reporting only to the Deputy Secretary and to the Secretary of State. I think that's probably as good a solution as any, although I'd be the first to tell you that if it is in the hands of the Foreign Service, it will look even worse after 2 years there than it looks now. So it has to be protected from my colleagues in the Foreign Service who couldn't manage a $50 bank account. But if you have the right undersecretary and it is separated out in terms of personnel from the rest of the department, I think it can work. Now, that's simply talking about the structure. What's the other part of it, which is the most important part? What philosophically do I think, again, either in the next 2 years or debate during the election, and if the Republicans win, certainly, what then happens in terms of what is the view of the purpose of economic assistance? I think it is 90% certain that the normal concept of aid for developing countries in need of a new highway or a factory here or waterworks there is a dead duck. I think there may be a little of that left simply to salve our consciences, but I think we will see, and again, I think with real popular support in the country, we will see a substantial change in the philosophy of what economic assistance is all about. I think we will see it focused much more on providing assistance to countries where we are interested in export promotion. We will see monies from AID ready to be used to sweeten the pot for a major contract to a consortium of American companies that want to build a dam in Indonesia or whatever. I'm not arguing whether it's good or bad. I'm simply saying I think what we're going to see is a focus much more on specific payback as defined by the Congress in terms of what comes back to the United States in terms of assistance to our own economy, and much less money given for what I would call philanthropic adventures. And that doesn't bother me as much as I know it will a lot of you, but let me just give you an example. for the 4 years in which I was back in the department under the Bush in the Bush administration, I fought tooth and nail to try to force some focus, even within the concepts of foreign assistance then extant, to try to force some focus on 5 or 10 or 15 major areas of need. And what I saw instead was one senator happened to have had a nice dinner with the King of Morocco, so all of a sudden there was $10 million for Morocco, and $5 million here and whatever. And as that kind of earmarking process went on, the money available for really sensible, even philanthropic kinds of operations simply became less and less available. With the fact that we are going to continue to give major amounts of money to Israel and Egypt, and that's just a given. It will not even be a debating issue. But because something like 50 to 60% of our aid budget is going to go to those two countries, you've got to start forcing some priorities on the other 40% that's left. And by the way, it will be a shrinking pot. The polls, interestingly enough, when you talk to Americans about where government ought to cut its expenditures, overseas assistance is at the very top of almost every list of polls that are taken. Yet it is less than 1% of our total foreign budget. So in terms of its real importance monetarily, it isn't particularly great, but it is certainly a focus of the American people. It's a focus of the Congress. And as I say, even I spent too many years being totally frustrated by a bureaucracy that simply could not move and move quickly and sensibly. And just one more point on that, and then I will move on to something else. But when it came to when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Warsaw Pact collapsed, and we were in dire need of trying to help the Poles and the Czechs and the East Europeans financially and in terms of assistance so that they could in fact begin to develop a separate existence from Russia and in fact begin to show their people that democracy and a market economy made sense. First place, we had trouble getting much money out of the Congress, but in the second place, I tried for the first 6 months to run it through AID, and in 6 months, we moved not one penny because the bureaucracy was so awful. So we went out and invented what we called enterprise funds and took the money and appointed a Wall Street banker who knew how to invest money as the head of the Polish enterprise fund. We set up enterprise funds for the other countries and just took it out of the hands of AID. And the Congress hated that. They're still working and apparently working pretty well. But again, my point simply is, if there's an area where I am sympathetic to a real revamping of an institution that has been a major part of our foreign policy for years, namely the overseas assistance program, it is so bad now that although philosophically the idea makes sense, I think it needs substantial revamping. There will be far less money for it. And we're going to have to be much more precise in how we target that money. And that, I think, either is going to happen anyway in this 2 years, or it will certainly be a focus of debate during the presidential election, although, as I say, I'm not sure the Democrats will fight it very much either. And I think after the president is elected, whomever he may be, this is one of the issues that, if it hasn't been settled beforehand, will certainly move forward thereafter. In talking to... I've said that I'm frustrated by what I consider to be the sort of ad hoc foreign policy of this administration. I can't tell you that I am wildly enthused about the ability of the Republicans in the Congress in the next 2 years to think creatively about foreign policy either. And I think that it's important to talk about this because I think it tends to tell you what the issues in foreign policy are going to be in the next election. And when I'm through with my list, I hope you will agree with me that it's a pretty pathetic list. my major message is, if I'm right now, 2 years before the election, the 1996 election is not going to go down in American history as a really creative campaign with regard to wither the United States and the free world in the course of the 21st century. Much as I think that is so terribly important. What are we getting now out of the Republicans? And I need to preface this again by saying, honestly, you can't expect the Congress to be much of a strategic thinker on these kinds of issues, and it's not built that way. But it gives, I think what's on their minds now will be a kind of an indication of what the issues are likely to be 2 years from now. First of all, there is this thing now about if we do peacekeeping, and by the way, the issue of peacekeeping itself deserves a great deal of debate, and I'll come to that in a minute, but to show you the level of debate, when we talk about peacekeeping now, the issue largely is that American troops should not serve under foreign commanders. And I understand that, but with all due respect, I think it's silly. It is my impression that Field Marshal Montgomery was British, not American. And he did reasonably well with a lot of American troops under him. In fact, if you will recall, at the Battle of the Bulge, General Eisenhower gave him half the American Army. The issue is not whether it's a foreign general. The issue is whether he knows his you-know-what from third base. And that's the question that has to be asked, not some inviolable rule that you will never have Americans serving under a foreign commander. Example, when President Bush decided to put troops into Somalia, and I went up to see Boutros Ghali, I knew how nervous the U.S. military were about being under foreign commanders. So I was beating up Boutros Ghali when I first went up and said, we want to do this in Somalia, but by golly, it's going to be our generals who are going to run things. And I came back, and Colin Powell came in one day, and he said, Larry, you don't have to be so tough. We know of a Turkish general that when the time comes to turn over, after we've done the first phase in Somalia, when it comes time to keep American troops there, but, try to hand over to the UN command authority, if the Secretary General appoints this Turk, we'll be perfectly relaxed. We've worked with him well. He knows his stuff. The issue is the quality of the commander. Now, I could go on. This is not an important subject other than to say it is the kind of easy issue to debate, and it has a certain visceral advantage to it in terms of talking to the American people who will like to hear it. But and with all due respect to those who argue this, it is not itself a fundamental issue if you are wise enough to understand that the real question is how qualified are the people that are going to in fact be doing the commanding, not what nationality are they. And it leads to the much more fundamental question, which is deserving of serious debate in this country. And I don't think we'll get it in the next 2 years. I hope it will produce some real and careful debate in the presidential election. And that is, what is the future of the UN in peacekeeping? I don't say peacemaking, peacekeeping. What kind of role should the US be playing in that process? What ought our limits to be? What ought our leadership thinking to be in trying to convince the rest of the world, or the UN at least, to become far more sensible about peacekeeping? We have seen in the last year or year and a half how monumentally unprepared the UN is to deal with these questions when they come at you hot and heavy. But it is not, I think, right to say that the UN has never been successful in peacekeeping, and I would suggest you look at Cyprus. I would suggest you look at the Sinai, which is an American operation, but it's under UN authority. There are a number of places where the UN has done very well in terms, if not of solving a problem, at least of keeping the peace. We have done, we have, are demonstrating day after day in Bosnia that we have the vaguest idea how to make peace. But that does not mean we should be cavalier about thinking about the issue of peacekeeping. What it does mean is that in a world in which, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and thereafter a much more unstable global situation, peacekeeping has become a much more, an issue much more in demand. We're now asked to do it in Somalia, and before long it's going to be Chechnya or someplace like that. But the fact of the matter is, we are putting, the UN is becoming active now in Angola. We don't know how to pay for these operations. We don't know where to get the troops to put into these operations. The troops that are put in usually have had no maneuvering time with anybody else that they're there with, if I can end the sentence with a proper preposition. And there is a great deal of waste, incompetence, and potentially serious loss of life simply because we have not thought through carefully enough how the UN or the world, I don't care if it's the UN or not, but how some institution is going to deal with the issue of peacekeeping in the coming decades. And I'm telling you now, if we haven't seen, if we haven't understood within the last 5 or 6 years how much more important that issue is than it has been, it is going to be with us for years to come, and we are going to have to learn how to deal with it better. And how to manage the process better. And we're also going to have to understand that the institutions, however they are developed, are not going to make any sense unless the U.S. is prepared to lead the way in creating the reform of those institutions and unless the U.S. is prepared to participate in peacekeeping operations. And that means both money and bodies on occasion. If we are of the view now that this is an issue that others should do and we should stand back and watch, then we might as well stop because it isn't going to work. As I think I've said to some of you who have been here before, I personally believe we're going to have to be involved. That does not mean it should be riflemen. It does mean we should provide lift, logistics support, communications, and on occasion some troops on the ground. But I think we have also learned to our sorrow that when you put American fighting troops into these operations, they become the targets of those who would rather see no peacekeeping operation at all, simply because we have demonstrated on more than one occasion that when we lose troops, we leave. That was clearly the case in Somalia. Therefore, I think we have to be careful how we participate. And I'm wandering off my subject again, but the point is, the 1996 election, I think, is going to have to face this question if it hasn't been resolved in the next 2 years or if we haven't had progress toward resolving it, and I don't think we will. But it will not be resolved sensibly if we start with a view that the UN is useless and we ought to have nothing to do with it. It may well be that it is now at this point close to useless. I would like you to suggest what you would replace it with. And I don't think at this point there is anything to replace it. Mexico and the debt crisis here in the last few weeks leads you to another clear issue of debate within the body politic, both now and at the time of the next election. And I will say to you, in my judgment, the congressional reluctance on Mexico is the closest, I'm going to exaggerate now, but not by much, I think. The congressional reaction on the issue of the Mexican crisis comes close to being the most obvious indication of a growing neo-isolationism in the United States of anything I can think of. I would say to you the opposition on NAFTA showed it, the opposition on the GATT, the World Trade Organization, showed it. But this, I think, is the most clear example of a tendency in this country that you may embrace. I think it's dangerous. Let me tell you why I say that. You have to start, I think, in the Mexican case, if you think about the subject at all, with a clear recognition that this country cannot, and in the end never will, permit the political and economic situation in Mexico to drift into revolution or chaos or economic collapse. We have a border. They are our next door neighbor. It has nothing to do with whether we love them or not. If you want to try to deal with 1.5 to 2 million refugees, or not refugees, illegal immigrants all of a sudden pouring over the border, and you will notice that President Clinton had to strengthen the border guards here a week ago in a situation where we are by and large saying we're going to help the Mexicans, that even then the illegal immigration increased substantially. I ask you to imagine what the situation would be like if in fact you had serious economic chaos in Mexico. And the answer, it seems to me, is so obvious that in the end, the United States has no choice but to provide whatever may be necessary in the end to prevent that kind of collapse in Mexico. Now, you can have all sorts of arguments against the $40 billion first suggested, but it was not itself money, it was a loan guarantee. And if the Jefferson Bank treated loan guarantees the way the Congress did, my wife and I would be living in a tent. There simply has to... All I'm really trying to say here is that this was nowhere near as serious a commitment of American resources as was made out to be. But again, my point is the debate on this subject simply demonstrated massive reaction in the country as such, and certainly in the Congress. And the reason in the end that President Clinton did what he did, which was use his own resources to commit $20 billion in loan guarantees, was because there was no way it was going to pass the Senate. Newt Gingrich told me that a week or so before the president changed, that at best the Senate had 18 votes in favor of the $40 billion loan guarantee. Now, you might have, with great debate and issue and discussion, you might have moved that up some, but the president was going to lose. And if we had lost that vote in the Senate or the House, the collapse in Mexico was assured, because 70% of that issue is psychological. And I will say, totally off the subject of the next election, that if the administration within a day or two at most of floating the peso, had gotten up, the president had gotten up and said, the United States is not going to let Mexico go down the drain, we will do what is necessary to prevent that, I think you would not have seen the disaster that in fact followed, because so much of it was atmospheric. But my point again, to try to get back to the election, is that to me there is a real indication here that the American people as such and their elected representatives have had it to a great degree with the kind of international involvement we have been so used to. Now, I think it relates back again to this question of aid and that kind of a function, because this was money. I think it also relates, however, to when you're about to put troops someplace. There is an automatic negative reaction which any administration is going to have to take into account. I believe myself, as I have said before, that because this is such a terribly important time in thinking about what the world's going to look like in the next century, that this fundamental attitude is dangerous. I think it also is going to affect, once again, this desire not to talk much about foreign policy in the next election. Republican or Democrat, this is not a partisan comment. But what it does say to me, that whomever the president is, he first of all, I think, has an obligation to argue with the American people about the importance that that we must, the role we must play in the coming decades. But secondly, it is going to be an uphill struggle for him. And if he's not prepared to take it on, I think we will lose another 4 years in trying to think through the kinds of problems we ought to be dealing with. I have wandered on much too much, and I mean wandered too. I haven't been terribly specific. Part of the reason is because I think the next election isn't, as I've said, is not going to be much about foreign policy. I think that's too bad. I think we need to be thinking seriously about what should NATO look like in the next decade, in the next century. And I think it is insane to say, well, we don't need it anymore. We ought to be taking the lessons of Bosnia and saying, we really messed this one up. Now, what can we do better the next time? The same is true with the UN. The same is true with this whole question of protectionism and international trade and finance. We're on a cusp here. We're on an edge. It's a blunt edge at this stage. I mean, we've got some room. But every day, month, year that goes by in this post-Cold War period, where we don't put our minds to thinking, when we don't put our minds to trying to be a George Marshall or a Dean Acheson, that wonderful generation, Harry Truman, that absolutely superb generation that fought their way through how to build a world that had lasted for 50 years and in the process wrecked the totalitarian, provided us with the strength and the organization to wreck the totalitarian threat we all faced. We need that kind of thinking again, and it's not there. I'd like to be able to say it will be there in the next presidential campaign. I'm surely going to try to make it so. And that and 25 cents will get you a cup of coffee. But it really is an issue that the American people need to be thinking about and need to be challenged on, and it's the campaign that gives you an opportunity. But I am not particularly optimistic that we'll settle much of that time. And I have blathered on far too long, and so I'll shut up. And if you want to, I'd like to, you know, answer questions, get into a debate. You can throw something at me if you'd like. I'll dodge it with my wife. Thank you.
Who'd like to begin the discussion? Yeah.
Bill Stevenson.
How does Colin Powell fit into the crowd question?
How does Colin Powell fit into the presidential equation, and which party, given his numbers in the polls, I certainly hope he's a Republican. How does he fit? I don't know. He's a great guy. He's bright. He's smart. Nobody knows what he thinks about anything other than on the military side. I suspect that the minute he commits himself with judgment on substantive issues, his polls will begin to go south. That's just inevitable. And that's not to say that he won't still be very popular, but it's easy to be for somebody when you don't know what he's for. And he's got a lot of charisma, and he speaks well. I would suspect that he is a Republican, certainly on defense and foreign policy issues. I would also suspect that he would be a liberal Republican on social and cultural issues, if not a Democrat, and probably on fiscal issues a Republican. How does he fit into it? I really don't know. In the first place, I'm not at all sure he wants to run. If you look at what it does to people and their families these days, I'm coming to the conclusion that we ought not want to elect anybody who wants the job because he's got to have something loose in his head. But I think he would be a formidable candidate. I don't think he would be the presidential nominee of either party. He could well be a vice presidential nominee. And it's in that, and this is not original thinking on my part, I read it in Time or someplace, that in that sense it's interesting that Doe was talking about only a four-year term, and Colin as the vice presidential nominee, that would be a very interesting ticket. I will tell you myself, if I could choose the next Republican vice presidential candidate, it would be Christy Whitman. I just think she's fantastic, and it's time we got a woman up there anyway. I said that only to keep peace in the family. Yes.
In the recent history of American politics, candidates who don't necessarily get the nomination have a capacity to, even though they don't win, to affect the national debate. Gephardt, even though his views were rejected, helped heighten trade as an issue. Bob Kerry in 92 helped to heighten health care as an issue. And Ross Perot, to an extent, helped to heighten the deficit as an issue.
And he certainly helped to put us out of office.
But do you think that Senator Lugar of Indiana, who is recognized by many as an incredibly articulate and thoughtful spokesman on foreign policy, if he decides to run for president, even if he doesn't get the nomination, do you think the effect of an aggressive Lugar campaign can help to inject foreign policy as an issue where it wouldn't ordinarily be?
No. He's a wonderful man, and he would be a great president, I think. He is not likely to get the nomination if he finds, and he's close to deciding to try, but he's not likely to get the nomination or come close to it. And I suspect he would be peripheral enough a candidate, I don't think, particularly in a time when neither party is particularly interested in making foreign policy an issue anyway. I don't think he'd make much difference on that subject. If he were the nominee, he would make a big difference. Because then I think he of all the people we could talk about, he's one of the few that would have a real foreign policy agenda and know what he wants to do, and he'd be fantastic at it. None would be another one on the Democratic side. But I don't think, in the terms in which you asked the question, that it would make much difference. He certainly isn't going to impact things the way Perot did, for instance. I would like it to be otherwise, but I don't think so. Yes?
It seems to me that international policy, foreign policy, is increasingly being replaced by trade policy or global trade policy. At least in this administration, if not in the next one, according to you, I think. My question is, do you think this is a global phenomenon and it's major gradual changeover? And is it being reflected in, for example, places like, for example, State Department bureaucracy?
The question is, it seems that trade policy is kind of replacing foreign policy. If you have a good foreign policy, it encompasses trade policy. But your point, nevertheless, is trade policy is kind of shoving everything else aside. Is this a good thing? And at least to some degree, more focused on the question of how it can relate to moving U.S. interests in trade policy, or in trade relations, or in export. I make no apology for that. We are going to have to learn to be much better exporters than we now are. And there is a role to be played in sweetening that pot a little bit. I know that sounds awful, but there is a role to be played through the assistance process. Trade policy in general, the issue of protectionism, the future of the GATT, and the future of trade relations between the major exporting countries of the world is clearly going to be a fundamental question in the next decades, I think. And if it is done badly, if we don't do well, it feeds the isolationism, the protectionism, the attitude of pox on all your houses that so worries me. It doesn't excessively worry me, but I think this is something we Americans have to worry about in our own country. So yeah, I think it's important? Will it, is it reflected in the changes in the State Department? I tried while I was still there. Clinton has been, one of the areas where I think the Clinton policy has been very good is in the whole issue of export promotion, trade, commerce, whatever else you all may think of the present Secretary of Commerce. I think he's done a superb job as Secretary of Commerce. Maybe not in some of his other extracurricular activities, but as Secretary of Commerce, he's, I think, been very, very good. And I think it's going to play an increasingly important role. And if that bothers people, just as when you get up and say we fought the Kuwait War in part because of oil, and that horrified everyone, and they are usually so young they can't remember when you had to sit in a line three blocks long to get gasoline. But these things are important, and I think trade policy is going to be increasingly important. And one of the reasons I think it's going to be increasingly important is because if we don't manage that process well, it is going to exacerbate all of the conflicts that are there to be had without much problem anyway. Let me make one more point on that. The European Community's decision to broaden and not deepen, the European Community's decision to take in Austria, or Sweden, Finland, and to broaden the institution is, I think, potentially a serious problem for us on the issue of protectionism in the future. Because they're not deepening those institutions, which certainly is going to be a problem for us if we ever hoped we were going to have a politically more coherent Western Europe that could be another pillar in the process of maintaining peace. Because it's now going exactly the opposite direction. They are not deepening their political institutions. And they are, because they're taking in all of these disparate economies, they're having to be much more careful about the kinds of decisions they make with regard to trade policy and so forth. And I think there is a potential tendency over time, given that, that we may find that the European Community becomes a much more protectionist organization because it's protecting the Greeks or Swedish fishing or whatever. And I think that could be a problem for us, which is another reason I think we have to be thinking hard about trade policy.
Colonel Foote.
Mr. Secretary, your comments about the aid program just about made my day.
Oh, I thought I'd be run out of time already.
According to the press, you've been recently in the Middle East, and I have for some time worried and been quite unable to understand why. I think we provide on the order of $4 billion a year to Israel, and I believe Egypt is the next level partner.
Right.
And I've been trying to persuade the congressmen that I know to try to cut back, particularly on that program, as one way to help reduce the deficit. But if you've been in the Middle East recently, would you comment a little on what you saw out there?
Yeah, and it's not going to make your day. Look, as I said during my remarks, Israeli assistance and Egyptian assistance are not going to be cut. And to some degree, that is, particularly in the Egyptian case, that's buying a continuing commitment to the peace process. I don't think it's too expensive. Because if there's one area where I am still reasonably optimistic, or every time somebody blows somebody else up, I get a little less optimistic. I really do think over there are real chances for a lasting peace in the Middle East now. But it's touchier every day that goes on. And I guess I'm not even going to try to argue about whether aid to Israel at this level makes sense or not. I will tell you intellectually and sort of philosophically, and I've said this to the Israelis, I think economic assistance should be cut and reduced, but certainly not military assistance. The day
we indicate, even today where things are not as bad as they were, that our commitment to assuring Israeli military superiority is in question, is the day I think you're asking for trouble. Now, it was much worse when the Soviet Union was still there, and the Syrians knew that if they went to war and lost their tanks, they'd get more. It's a different situation, but nevertheless, certainly as far as Iran and Iraq and those states that are against the peace process are concerned, I don't want to give the least indication that we won't do whatever we have to militarily to assure Israel's ability to have military superiority to defend itself. On the economic side, and this is not popular, on the economic side, I think there is reason to reduce. In fact, I would say to you, and this is a classic problem, I think the economic assistance in the Israeli case has made it possible for the Israelis to avoid making some of the tough decisions they ought to make with regard to getting their economy in shape. And I think a lot of Israelis would agree with that. Now, having said that, I will also tell you that is not a particularly popular view of Congress, and I think you can expect very little in the way of change in that regard. What were my feelings about the trip to the Middle East? Well, it was basically a trip to Israel. And I took, we took Lamar Alexander and his wife and Howard Baker and traveled around. And I should make no secret of it. I think Lamar Alexander is a partner in Howard Baker's law firm. He's a former governor of Tennessee. He's running for president, and I'm helping him where I can. I have been in the process of working with Howard Baker and Lamar Alexander. Learned a great deal more about the state of Tennessee than I ever wanted to know. but he's a good guy. But anyway, I guess the impression I would, the feelings I come away with are, I am an unadulterated, fervent admirer of Rabin. I think he is one of the most intelligent, serious, and decent people in office in internationally that I know. I think he really sincerely is doing what he can to try to bring about a peace settlement. It is, I think, also clear that his political strength at home is less than it was because of all of the killing and his continuing desire to try to keep the process going. There is a clear debate and division within Israel between the Likud, led by Mr. Netanyahu, and the governing labor coalition with regard to the peace process, and the Likud is less than enthusiastic about it all. I don't think they would turn the clock back, but I think they would be far more cautious about future concessions. And one of the areas where this will be a great debate is the Golan Heights, if and when that ever gets to be, if we ever get to the point of them negotiating with Syria. All of that, I think, is secondary to my basic feeling coming out of Israel. I've been there so many times that at least I think I can make some judgments of how one related to the other. And what I kind of came away with was tired, frustrated, going from real hope not too many months ago to this awful mess. And there is, you know, think of yourself walking down Main Street in Charlottesville and having to worry about whether a bus is going to blow up and kill you and 20 or 30 others. That does not make for a lot of relaxed walking down streets. And that's there all the time. And I think it is, in fact, a remarkable comment that the commitment to the peace process in terms of the body politic is still as strong as it is. I came away, as I always do, with tremendous admiration for their guts. And beyond that, this just can't go on. They've got to work the peace process. And the Israelis are sometimes their own worst enemies in terms of settlements going, you know, and at the same time they're trying to work an agreement with Arafat. And by the way, he is about as, I need to be careful, but Arafat is not the world's most astute bureaucrat. He may be a very good politician, but one of the problems is that he has not established any kind of structure that permits the aid money that's ready to go there to go. And so as a, one of the things that was is absolutely essential is that Arafat has to show the average Palestinian that life can be better with a peace process and that economically things will begin to improve. And that's what the whole concept of the economic assistance programs were and the American willingness to contribute. But if what you've got is a couple of people who are sitting there to take the money and you don't know if it's going into their Swiss bank account or if it's ever going to be used at all, you're not likely to give them the money. And the money hasn't moved, and the reason is basically because Arafat has not, he still wants to run it all out of his hat. I'm not even sure he wants to, you know, put the money in his pocket. He's just not used to running a state, and that's one of the real, that's one of the real roadblocks right now to moving even the process with the PLO forward. If I sound pessimistic, I shouldn't. I think it's a touchy time. Yes. Since I saw you nod yes a couple times when I said something, I figured I was going to get a good question.
This is not so much a question as a bit of role playing. You are now the Republican candidate for president.
If I am,
you were so impressive. And you are in Washington, D.C. And we have just heard that you've made an eloquent speech at the Miller Center here, where you debated that we'll never let Mexico slip into chaos or revolution, and that the case for Israel, where we cannot allow those people to live in such a constant state of uncertainty and brutality. And now we have Washington, D.C., where you, it mirrors in many ways the kind of terrorist activities that any of the developing countries are experiencing. Mr. Candidate, make your argument why we bail out Mexico and not Washington, D.C. And I'm all up for temporary neo-isolationism, like sort of like temporary. I'm up for temporary isolationism, a little bit like temporary amnesia, maybe for a year.
You've asked the wrong question, with all due respect, because you've assumed that one is exclusive of the other. That if we bail out Mexico, we can't bail out Washington. I will tell you, having lived in one and spent a lot of time visiting in the other, I think we are likely to be more successful in Mexico.
I want you to know I represent Mary and Barry, but go on.
Mary and Barry's it's very interesting. I think he's showing he's a lot more than a lot of us thought he was. That having been said, it really is. We're back down to this question that we, in the last decade, have not been able to solve and haven't even tried to solve. And I'm not going to say something that is partisan, but I mean it as more than that. The exciting thing about what happened in November, exciting, maybe, but Washington is more exciting. The dead hand of 40 years having been run by the Democrats, and in that sense, I would have said the same thing if it had been 40 years of Republicans. Don't get me wrong. But what I see, at least, whether you like what the proposals are, there is so much more life in the Congress, particularly in the House. There's also too much blathering on occasion, but there's... I mean, Newt Gingrich, I think, is a wonderful guy. I just wish he could be quiet. But the point is, there's so much more life, and what there's a relationship to what you asked. These guys and girls, men and women, are talking priorities. That it is time we figured out what's important and what isn't, and stop spending money on the unimportant or the semi-important, and put it into things that are important. I don't know how to solve the Washington problem, but I am prepared to say to you that I think we have an obligation to try to do both. And it's not because I'm philanthropic about Mexico. I am simply telling you, if Mexico turns turtle or becomes a real unstable mess, the consequences for us are going to be awful. And we need to get that through our head. Washington, D.C. ought not be the kind of city it is. I think it's possible to do both, and I'm not sure that answers your question. Except to say, if you're going to force me to make a choice between cleaning up Washington and seeing that Mexico doesn't go down the tube, I am going to say Mexico comes first, and that's why I'm never going to get elected.
You do it.
Victor.
One more point on Mexico. As in, being familiar with inside the Beltway, can you explain to me why there was all the euphoria and the push for NAFTA, and I'm for free trade? Then in December, Secretary Benson retired, and then about a week later, they devalued the peso. Why didn't someone know that was sitting there?
The question, in case you couldn't hear it, was basically, why didn't we know that the peso was going to be devalued? Here we had all of this euphoria about NAFTA and how wonderful it was for Mexico and the relationship. Benson retires, the Mexicans devalue the peso, and the roof falls in, or the basement collapses, I don't know which, but why didn't somebody know it? It's a very good question, and it is now going to give me a chance to... I shouldn't play partisan politics at the University of Virginia, so I'll clean up my language, but my point here is, they should have known, and I will tell you, I think they knew. If you had a brain in your head and knew anything about exchange rates and anything about Mexico, you had to know the peso was going to have to be devalued. The Mexican government, I frankly think it's too bad Salinas didn't do it before he left, but, you know, he would have preferred to leave it to his successor, and he did. And I guess that's normal human behavior. But it has been months that everybody knew they were going to have to devalue. The Mexicans messed it up by doing it the way they did it. And I think without any real warning to us or anybody else, they just kind of did it. But there should have been no doubt in our minds, and I think, in fact, there was no doubt, that this was going to happen and we ought to be prepared for it. Here's my point, and I think that your reference to Benson may in fact be correct, because I think he was a first-class Secretary of Treasury. But here's my point, and I'll say it in a different way for a minute here, but I have no idea whether the current candidate to be Surgeon General of the United States is a good guy or not. I will tell you, after 2.5 years of screwing around with their nominating process, if somebody in the White House didn't have enough brains before they put the name out into the public to have asked all the questions that they should have asked. I mean, if when they first came into office, I'll excuse them. You come from Arkansas, you don't do it the same way. But 2.5 years later, yeah. I mean, it is simply inconceivable that they didn't have enough, that the staff work in the White House is still that awful. The same, in a way, I think is true about the Mexican peso devaluation. And I said kind of, in a way, I indicate, they should have had a folder in the desk that said, what do we do when they devalue the peso? And you have a little game plan laid out. I mean, we did that all the time, and it's not hard. I mean, and Lyndon Johnson's people did it. This is not a Republican monopoly. But all they needed was this thing, and the first thing that should have happened, seriously, the top of that list ought to be the president gets out and says, nothing's going to happen. we are not going to let this go to hell. Because so much of this is a psychological issue. And what they did instead was bungle around. In the first place, the president of Mexico says he's going to make a speech and then puts it off for 48 hours. The arbitragers are having a field day. And they have made more money in the course of the last month. And yeah, it's true. To do what we're going to have to do, we're going to be bailing out a lot of rich people in Mexico and some bankers in New York. That's true. There's nothing to... You can't hide that fact. The only thing is, if you don't do it, what's going to happen is going to be so much worse that we'll wish we'd done it. But again, I'm wandering on. My only point is, I cannot conceive how they didn't know. I cannot conceive how they weren't ready within 24 hours at most to get out and begin to deal with it psychologically. And I have to tell you, I think basically it was bad staff work.
My implication to this question, what happened on November 8th is a reflection of it, that the American public was misled that everything was hunky-dory in Mexico. So that's what happened.
Well, no, okay, again, my only point, I'm an ardent advocate of NAFTA, and I don't think NAFTA had anything to do one way or the other. Everything is not hunky-dory in Mexico. I will tell you, though, in Salinas' 6 years, it is so much better than it was 6 years ago. Mexico is on the come. It's gonna be all right. It's gonna take time. But if it isn't all right, we're gonna have to try to do what we can to make it so. My boss tells me two more questions. I've talked too long already. Is there some
Victor Yankee?
Wait a minute.
Mr. Ambassador,
I'll go ahead, but. This male chauvinist never asks ladies questions. So you're next.
Mr. Ambassador, since the 1967 war, when so many Palestinians were dispersed all over the Middle East and in Europe, is there any force that you can see that those kind of people may return to Palestine and form a more organized way of governing the state?
Not really. And I don't think Arafat wants them back. The question is, to all of those who might not have heard it, with all of the Palestinian diaspora spread out, certainly all over the Middle East and in Europe and so forth, is there any chance they could come back into a Palestinian state? And I guess the answer is, in the abstract, yes. There isn't a lot of room. And until that Palestinian entity is in a lot better economic shape than it now is, it just overloads the circuit. In the Palestinians in and around the Middle East they're bright, they're capable, they're probably the most westernized and I happen to think therefore creative people in the region in terms of business and so forth. I think a lot of them over time might come back, but not in the conditions as they now are. And if I were a Palestinian, I wouldn't want to come back right now until things have settled down a lot. Ma'am.
What do you argue should be the role of NATO in the next 5 to 10 years? Should it continue to exist, and if so, why?
What should be the role of NATO in the next 5 to 10 years? Should it continue to exist, and why? It's not just the next 5 to 10 years. I would hope it's there for a lot longer than that. But let me start with the simplest reason. Yes, it ought to continue. But let me start with the simplest reason and move from that. It simply cannot be the assumption that went with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that now it was all over and we were going to get the peace dividend. It should be obvious to everybody now that that is at best questionable. Is there anybody here that can tell me that with confidence that they know what Russia's going to look like a decade from now? I can't. I hope that Yeltsin succeeds and that the economy becomes a good solid market economy and democracy takes root. And I could not give you the barest sense of confidence that that's what will happen. I can also tell you simply in terms of being careful that if you look at the last 500 years of Russian history, not communist history, Russian history, It is an aggressive, it has been an imperialist expansionist state. Chechnya is not just about that, but there, you cannot assume that the leopard has lost all its spots or stripes or whatever leopards have. So all I'm saying is, you have to play against the concern about where Russia may be 10 years from now. And there are still a lot of nuclear weapons lying around there. So therefore, it seems to me that NATO serves the continuing purpose of assurance or insurance in terms of Western Europe. Secondly, I think there is merit to some of the democratic East European states, particularly Poland and the Czech Republic, probably Hungary, being taken into NATO, although I think there's good reasons for debating the subject, simply because it's more than time that we said, after 200 years of history, that Central Europe is no longer up for grabs, that there is it is related to something. It's not sitting in the middle between the two contending parties. Thirdly, I think there is very good argument to be made that NATO needs to think about the Yugoslav kind of disaster and how that might have been dealt, how that might be dealt with in the future. I think, you know, and we were the guys in charge when Yugoslavia went to hell. But if we'd had a NATO as an institution that had thought through what they would do with these kinds of cases, so there could have been a collective decision made within an institution that was used to making collective decisions, rather than the sort of ad hoc way in which we had to play it, with the Germans clearly not interested at all in trying to prevent the disaster that happened in Yugoslavia. It might have made a difference. And what I'm really saying is there's the whole North African littoral, which I think is clearly under threat from Muslim fundamentalism. What could be the role of NATO there? There's a whole world out there, and I don't mean in Indonesia, but there's a whole world out there that an effective NATO could provide substantial, at least some sense of stability. So I think there's a real role to be played, but we've got to think through what that is. And the professor here is now beginning to bounce. So I want to thank you all very much.